You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me today is my mom, Caroline Kilborn. How are you today, Mom?
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm good. It's another beautiful day.
It is. Gosh. Well, springtime in Iowa. You know, we have a few days of this a year before it gets way too hot.
Yeah, I know. But you know, all the trees are leafed out now and everything is just amazing.
Spring took its time getting here, and then it came on really, really fast.
Yes, it did. Yeah. Really, really fast.
And we are very happy for that.
Yes, we are.
Well, we have a really interesting book today. It's a historical novel called The Way of Beauty by Camille DeMaio. Camille DeMaio always dreamed of being a writer, and those dreams came to fruition with her best-selling debut novel, The Memory of Us. She and her husband split their time between Texas and Virginia, homeschool their four children, and lead an award-winning real estate team in San Antonio, Texas. Welcome to Writers' Voices, Camille DeMaio.
Hi, thanks for having me.
The Way of Beauty is your third published novel, then?
It is.
Wow. When did the first one come out?
The Memory of Us came out in 2016, and the next was 2017, and then I've got this one, and I've got one coming out in March of next year, so I seem to be on about a one-year schedule.
Wow, you're really on a roll.
Oh, my. I should say I'm homeschooling.
Yes, but we've been doing that for a long time, so it doesn't seem like this big thing anymore, where it's just our lifestyle.
Now, the Way of Beauty is set in the early 1900s to mid-1900s in New York City.
Yeah.
Why there? You know, what drew you to that time period and that geographical location for this novel?
I've traveled a lot, and I have to say New York City is just my favorite place in the world for a lot of different reasons. So I always knew I wanted to set a book in New York City, and there's a million stories you can tell. And I read one day about Penn Station because I just love the romance of train travel. And as I researched Penn Station, I saw these beautiful, beautiful photos with these glass cathedral-like ceilings. And I thought, gosh, I have never been upstairs. I've only been down to the bowels of Penn Station, the concrete tunnels. I just must not have gone upstairs. But then I realized that big, awesome, beautiful train station didn't actually exist anymore. It was demolished in the 1960s in order to build Madison Square Garden. But there was quite a story behind what it took to dig the tunnels under the rivers to the train station and to build the station itself. And I realized how much drama there was just with that setting. I thought, wow, I can really insert the lives of some characters and parallel the story of Penn Station with the lives of these women. And it took me on such a fun journey of learning about women and women's rights and suffragettes. All of these things that were important to women at this time period, but all with the backdrop of this very dramatic train station. So that's where the idea got started, and I ran with it.
Now, Camille, one of your main characters is the child of German immigrants, and the other is the child of Italian immigrants. Do you have those heritages in your own family?
I do. I'm half Italian and half German, although my family has all been here for several generations. But my husband is first generation on both sides. He is also half Italian and half German. And they're very different personalities, those two sides of things. And so it's funny how he and I balance each other and end up understanding each other when I'm being a little more German and he's being a little more Italian. We just kind of get it about each other. But those traits definitely made their way into the book, and they're near and dear to my heart. So in writing a book where there were immigrants, those were my natural choices.
I was going to say, I thought that you portrayed the different ones very, very well. And, you know, that their immigration status and so forth. I thought that was really good.
It was really difficult for immigrants in the city and at the turn of the century in the early 1900s, wasn't it?
It was. And, I, you know, if I had just run solely with that aspect of the story, there's even more that you can tell. It's a backdrop for my book in a relatively small part. But the plight of the immigrants coming in is remarkable. And there are so many more stories to tell about it. And I'm already kind of thinking about where I might want to bring that into future books. But they took the jobs that nobody wanted. They worked worked to the bone. One of my characters is one of the men who actually built the tunnels underneath the East and Hudson rivers. And it was terribly dangerous work. And he becomes very sick from it, actually. But that's all he could get, not speaking English. And, a lot of them really suffocated their original languages in order to try to assimilate and learn English. And I bring that into the book a little bit, too. You had to let go of any identity you had before.
Well, you know, it hasn't changed that much even now for immigrants.
No, as I was saying that, I was thinking that there's still very similar issues.
Yes.
Maybe the countries that they're coming from are different now.
Yes.
But the issues are the same. The job, being exploited in a sense in the job market hasn't changed.
That's right.
With this book, both with the immigrant storylines and the women's storylines in the book, that's what I love about historical fiction is the issues that people were dealing with 100 years ago are really not very different, be it the women, the immigrants. We're dealing with a lot of the same issues. And I think historical fiction teaches us where we came from and also shows us our similarities. And I love that about the genre.
Right.
Were both of your earlier books historical fiction as well?
They were. And my fourth one is as well. And I'm not saying I'll never branch out someday, but I just deeply love going back about 80 to 100 years and looking at all those similar issues, but how they had to deal with them in different ways. They didn't have cell phones or the internet, and they didn't have some of the technological advances. So it creates even more opportunities for drama. And you add, world wars in there and everything. It's just a great playground for an author to have such rich details to use in books.
Well, what were the settings for your earlier books?
The Memory of Us was set in around World War II in Liverpool and London, and it was originally inspired by the song Eleanor Rigby by the Beatles, which is why I set it in Liverpool, and just really loved that setting. I've always loved reading Jane Eyre and British novels, so it was fun to set that there. And Before the Rain Falls was set in a border town in South Texas. And being a fourth generation Texan, that was just something I dearly loved writing about in that location. And my upcoming one, my fourth one, is set in Coronado, California. So I really love to have a sense of location and place in my books. It's kind of my launching point.
And what about time? Are they all in the similar time?
Roughly, they're all in the 20th century, and so I don't personally care to read things that go back too much further than that. I like it to still be close enough that maybe our grandparents would remember some of those details. So I like being close enough to that, but I don't like being completely modern. So it's good period for me.
How do you research the details to know, like, in 1912? Did trains, what were the train schedules like? What were the trains themselves like? The kind of the daily, day-to-day details that maybe don't get recorded that often. How were you able to establish the authentic realities?
The internet is such an amazing resource. I use a lot of YouTube, and I look at a lot of images online, and sometimes you can find articles, letters. So I kind of, for example, with train travel, I've done a lot of train travel. So I start with what my own experience is, and that's what I kind of write in a chapter. And then I think, okay, I take myself through every step of that process and say, how would it have been back then? And so I kind of work backwards, and I make any corrections. Sometimes the experience is very similar, and many times it's very different. So I start with that. And then once in a while, there's just a detail that you cannot find because it's very obscure. And so I just make a really educated guess as to what that might have been like. But probably for 80% of what I write, I do find the details somewhere. And I research it until either I've exhausted possibilities or until I find my answer.
So, Mom, did when particularly when you were reading the part that was set during World War II, were there things that you remembered from your own youth that you could identify with?
Well, of course, we had, you know, we had rationing. There were some candy bars you couldn't buy because they were sending them overseas, and that was fine. And of course, sugar was rationed. And there were some other things that were rationed, but you know, I never felt like I was deprived of anything. And of course, in the Midwest, everybody had a victory garden, and everybody mm-hmm. grew their own, you know, vegetables and everything. And of course, we had a big orchard, so we had fruit and everything. So we were very fortunate. In the city, I don't know. I can't imagine what it might have been like in the city. Might have been very, very, very different, I imagine.
I know that they took little patches of land, and there were definitely victory gardens there. Anywhere where anybody could plant anything, they were doing that in the cities too, although with the population, I'm sure that was much harder for those to be effective there.
Yeah.
Right. You even have a mention of one of your characters starting a victory garden in a park.
Yes, they were really using every bit of space that they could for those kind of things. So I do like to bring those details in. The memory of us focuses much more on World War II, and so even though part of The Way of Beauty takes place during that time, I really was focusing on how things were affecting New York specifically, because I felt like I'd cover some of that other ground in The Memory of Us when it was much more about the war.
So, Mom, you got a chance to really delve into this book. Do you have some questions for Camille?
Well, I was interested in the suffragette movement because and Pearl's involvement in it, because she came from a very wealthy family, and I was wondering in your research, were there many wealthy women that got into this thing of voting? Did they, or was it mostly just the common everyday person?
There were definitely some of the very wealthy women involved in it, but there was a lot of here's luncheons, we're going to raise money, we're not really getting our hands too dirty. That was probably the more widespread experience. My character of Pearl, she witnesses some very horrendous things, though, because she is a little bit closer to the action with her father actually owning some warehouses and so forth and some factories. So she takes a much more hands-on approach than most women of her status would have been. So her family's initially, you know, patting her on the back for getting involved. But then when she really, really digs in, they're not so happy about that.
And, right. Of course, well, then she marries the wrong man.
Right. Twice. She becomes a widow, having definitely married the wrong man, according to her family, and then just goes and does it again. So it's kind of cementing her fate with that. But I really enjoyed learning about that. I did not know a lot about suffragettes going into that time. And I'm a very avid voter. I vote in every election, even the local ones that come along. And I completely appreciate that right and who died for us to have that right. But I hadn't really dug into the lives of the suffragettes and the sacrifices they made. And I learned amazing things about what they did and their hunger strikes and their force feedings and dug into the march from Washington, D.C. from New York to Washington, D.C. in the winter. Really fascinating stuff, and just makes me appreciate, you know, next time I go to vote, I'm, all of that is going to really come to mind in a very present way.
Now, I'm ashamed to say I'm not sure how that happened. Was it a national thing that they passed in Congress, or did the states have to ratify it individually?
Some of the states were letting women vote far before it was an amendment, a nationwide amendment. So there was even a woman who was elected to Congress from Montana years ago, years before the 19th Amendment happened. So there were some great things happening primarily in the West. The West was getting it before the East was, in many cases, the Midwest. So yay, Midwest. So there's a lot of great things going on much earlier, but it finally culminated nationwide, which was great. But there were very coordinated efforts eventually among all of the different states and the women in the states and communication that allowed it to be a national conversation.
You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Camille DiMaio, author of The Way of Beauty. She's also the best-selling author of The Memory of Us and Before the Rain Falls. So, Camille, tell me, did you always want to be a writer?
I did. Ever since I was in grade school, I spent recesses in the library. I was not terribly athletic or coordinated, but I loved to read. So I spent my recesses in the library, and it was pre-internet, so I was just fascinated by the names of these authors on these books. They were just legendary to me, and I wanted to be one of them someday, but you couldn't, you know, go Instagram them or message them now as you can, which is such a fascinating and wonderful part of today's bit of being an author. But it really created this lore around them, and I was just so wrapped up and fascinated by that. And I just read and read and read. I don't have any formal education in writing, but I've read so many books. And so I feel like I absorbed a sense of story and what works in a story just by reading a lot.
Go ahead,
Mom.
I was going to say, then when you went to research, when you go to research some of these things, you sort of have an idea of where to go to look, don't you?
I do. I have a very, very light outline when I start. I kind of think of it as a skeleton. And because the history just is so rich and some of the things that are most fascinating, I don't find out until I'm actually in the research process. I save a lot of opportunity to put the meat on those bones for the research. So some people are amazing plotters, and they have these huge rooms full of post-it notes, and they know exactly what's going to be in every single chapter. And I admire that, but I'm afraid that if I put myself in that corner of a structure too early, I would really miss the opportunity to include some of these fascinating things I learn along the way. So I really have almost just a very thin idea of what's going to happen when I start out.
So with The Way of Beauty, you started with this location, Penn Station in New York, the time. Did you immediately know that you wanted to involve the suffragette movement in the storyline?
I did not. In fact, the character of Pearl, who is a suffragette, she really was going to be a fairly minor character to start out with. And this is where I love how, you know, she was going to get a little bit more than a mention. She'd have some scenes, but not be a major character. But as I researched that element of women in that time period, and that was such an important element of women in that time period, she just became a much, much bigger character, because I couldn't tell the story of the suffragettes without telling Pearl's story. And she just needed to become a bigger character at that point. So that's where I like to leave lots of room for those kind of changes for myself.
And did you think about making Vera more involved in the suffragette movement as instead of telling Pearl's story, or would that just not have worked?
Well, my character Vera, her mother's no longer alive. She dropped dead of exhaustion working in a factory, and her father was one of the sandhogs building the tunnels. And so he's very ill still from the effects of the bends, which was a common ailment. So she is trying to support them and be his caregiver. She really doesn't have the time to go become an activist. It's really not even on her radar. But when she encounters Pearl, who is the fiance of the man she loves, she's ready to be all jealous, but finds that she's very fascinated by these causes that Pearl is taking up. So she does get involved, but it's a little bit more peripheral because she still has some pretty overwhelming opportunities. So she does what she can, but I couldn't make her somebody who drops everything to be an activist, because she has a very ill father to take care of, and that's her priority.
She does realize, though, that how important her role is in caring for William. so that Pearl can, you know, can do what she has to do.
She does. And, you know, like a lot of different issues, not every one of us can be the ones on the front line of something, but we can be support. And support is every bit as important. And at different times in my life, I've either been somebody campaigning for issues I believe in, or I've been somebody who's donated or made, you know, phone calls. And it's a little bit more of a background role. But you need all of those roles. And so Vera definitely does things that allows Pearl to go be the activist she can. But not every single person needs to be a Pearl.
Right. Nor can they, because they don't have the stamina or the, you know, that was that.
It takes all time. Beauty of humanity.
It does, yes.
Camille, where did the title come from and what does it mean to you?
The Way of Beauty came from the idea that we have this train station that was built to be one of the most beautiful in the world, bigger than anything in London or Paris, and it was stunning. And then it goes through its building, its heyday, but then it goes into decline. As airplane travel and car travel become a lot bigger, train travel declines, and with it, the station is not kept up very well. There's just not the money. And eventually, they're in the red so poorly that they sell the land, the property, to the Madison Square Garden Corporation, and it disappears completely. So there's this arc of it's big and beautiful and shiny and new and exciting, and then it's just kind of mundane. We're coming in and out, and then it declines. And I think that life can take that path. So I make a point in there of saying, you know, when we're little, everybody's celebrating every step and every first tooth and every first word. And then, you know, we just are living our lives, and then there is a beauty, too, in the decline. But as I point out there, whereas a building can be destroyed and it doesn't exist, we can reinvent ourselves at any age, and that's the way of beauty. We have these highs and these lows, but we can have these highs again, and that's the way of beauty that parallels that. Also, I named the character of Angelo, his last name is Bella Via, which means beautiful way in Italian. And so that was my little extra nod to the name.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Camille DeMaio, author of The Way of Beauty. Camille, could you read a little bit from the book for us?
Sure. I picked out a selection as part of Chapter 2. And what's happening here is the character Vera, who's the German immigrant taking care of her father. Ever since she was 5 years old, she's been in love with Angelo. He's 9 years older, and she met him when she was a little girl and was just fascinated by him, because New York's a tough place to live for a little girl who doesn't speak much English. And as she gets older, she turns 17, she's still in love with him, and they've become good friends, so she is convinced that he's about to propose to her, because he now sees her as the young woman that she is. So she, we pick up here where she's about to meet him and is very excited about this and thinks that this is where her life is finally going. Okay. She'd never told him about Angelo, who was 9 years older than Vera. And though she loved her father, it was times like this when she felt most acutely the lack of having a mother. Just a year ago, Vera had feared that any romantic thoughts about Angelo lay squarely in her imagination. But recently, his hand would brush against hers, and he would not pull away. Maybe it was her naivete. He was Italian, after all, and from a family that was overtly physical in their affection for one another. She went back and forth, convincing herself that every gesture meant something, or alternatively, that it was all in her head. For all she knew, Angelo might still see her as the child she was when they'd met. He had done then what any kind person would do when faced with a little girl with a scraped knee. When she told him through sobs that she and her parents had just moved to the boarding house across the street, he'd seemed to understand how that might be frightening. When she returned from school the following day, Angela had called her over to him, to her from his post behind the magazine. A boy stood steps away, a younger sibling of his, she guessed, bellowing headlines that Vera didn't understand. McKinley wins re-election and landslide victory. Angelo had shouted her name again, and Vera could still feel the flush that had come over her when she realized that he'd remembered it at all. She'd stepped in a mud puddle racing over to him, dirtying the brown leather boots she'd received in a charity box full of cast-offs. But she didn't care. They were two sizes too big for her anyway, and the laces were frayed at the ends. "Ah, kid," he'd said in the accent that she immediately loved. "Your knee, it's better today?" She lifted the hem of her dress to show him. Bene, he said, inspecting it. But you know what would make it feel faster? Nien, she answered, slipping into her native German tongue. Gelato. You've had ice cream, right? She nodded. Eccellente. Then you have to try gelato. Italian ice cream. Much better. Come? He'd held out his hand, and she slipped her tiny palm into his large one. Angelo told the boy to mind the newsstand and walked Vera around the corner, where he said that his nonna made the best ice cream she would ever taste. And he'd been right. She'd tried the pistachio, like he suggested, while he told her about the first time he'd had gelato, right around her age, in the Piazza Navona in Roma, where he'd grown up before coming to America. He'd made it sound so exotic and told her that she would have to go someday. As they exited the shop, Angelo had stopped in front of a large pebble that lay on the sidewalk. He kicked it down the street and invited Vera to take her turn. Her little legs carried her swiftly to where it rested, and she gave it a try, sending it only a few feet. Angelo caught up and sent it soaring, grazing the top hat of a man walking toward them and garnering an ugly retort. Vera stifled a giggle, mirrored by Angelo, and they continued their game until they returned to his newsstand. "Here we are, kid," he'd said. She winced at the nickname, already wishing that she was 14 just like him, practically an adult. "Back to work for me and home for you. Glad your knee is better. Come back and see me sometime. You'll have to try the stracciatella. No one makes it like my nonna." "Thank you," she'd whispered. "And how do you say that in German?" Her eyes widened at his encouragement of the language she knew so well. Everyone else tried to make it go away, as if there was something bad about it, bad about her. "Danke." "Danke," he'd repeated, "and it's grazie in Italian." Vera remembered how she'd had to strain her neck to look all the way up at him, how tall he'd once seemed to her, although now she'd nearly caught up. Vera reread his note from today. "Meet me at our spot on the steps of Penn Station, 3 p.m. I have something important to tell you." Today might be the first time he would kiss her, and she would only need to raise herself slightly on her tiptoes to meet him. She'd pictured this moment for so long, and now it was upon her, upon them. Vera brushed her hair through her fingers and rearranged the silver clip. She'd always liked how it looked against her blonde hair. In contrast, Angelo seemed so exotic to her with his wavy dark hair and deep brown eyes. What might their children look like? She smiled. She was getting ahead of herself. Vera pinched her cheeks, a poor girl's rouge. She bit her lips to redden them and slipped on a wool sweater. Her feet barely touched the wood stairs as she hurried down to the street. It was only four blocks and one avenue to the other side of the train station. Penn was a microcosm of the city with its oceans of steps, towering columns, hurrying commuters. It had allowed people with money to move out of the city into Long Island and Connecticut. It was the fourth largest building in the world, 70 acres of floor space. And people who knew such things said that its grand concourse was the size of the nave of St. Peter's Church in Rome. Vera enjoyed watching the well-dressed men sidestep the flower sellers and the coiffed women cling to their handbags as they walked next to the beggars. She might never be able to see the world, but all the world came to her through the tunnels of Penn Station. She and Angelo liked to sit on the steps and guess the nationalities of the people who would walk by speaking languages they couldn't decipher. Angelo understood this about Vera, and they had this in common, that as big as they could dream, they could be just as happy amusing themselves with these simple pastimes. As Vera approached the station, she saw one of the elegant sorts of ladies from afar. Her long, pale pink coat screamed quality even from this distance. She wore tall boots and a hat with lace trim that stopped just short of her eyes. Vera was just about to avert her own eyes to look for Angelo when he suddenly appeared next to the woman. Vera quickened her steps, tingling with anticipation. She raised her arm to wave, but Angelo wasn't looking at her. He was still looking at the woman. Why wasn't he walking toward Vera? The woman smiled when she saw Angelo and slipped her gloved hand through his arm. His smile matched hers, wider even. Only then did he turn and see Vera. Her heart sank like lead. Something was wrong. "Hey, kid," he shouted. She cringed. "Kid," he repeated as she walked up to them. The woman had not let go of his arm, and Vera was appalled to see that she was even more beautiful up close. Perfect white skin, lips that looked as if they were stenciled by a gifted artist, eyes that seemed translucent. "Ah, there you are, va bene. I can always count on my German friend to be right on time." It was an old joke. Vera arrived 5 minutes early everywhere she went, and Angelo would be at least 10 minutes late. "Angelo," she said, hoping her voice didn't shake. She avoided looking at the woman. "Thanks for meeting me here today. I told you I had something important to tell you." There was a look in his eyes that she didn't recognize and couldn't begin to interpret as he went on. I want you to meet Pearl Pilkington, my fiancé. Yeah, that seems
And that was Camille DeMaio reading from The Way of Beauty.
And right away, you have a lot of sympathy for her, for Vera, because, you know, she's been in love with this guy for quite a while and admired him and everything, and they were both, you know, from immigrants. And then all at once, wham, he's going to marry this other gal. So, and it goes
right
from there.
That's right. So there's some love triangles going on in this story among all the history. I always like to add a little bit of romance. And the surprise to Vera is she ends up becoming good friends with Pearl when she expects to be kind of jealous.
Yeah, I thought that was good. I thought that was a really good line because she was very important in Pearl's life and as caregiver for her son. And also, Pearl knew that she supported her cause, even though she couldn't participate, you know, in it, but she still, and I think that was important to Pearl.
Well, and we do so much better as women to support each other than to tear each other down. And that's really an element of female friendship I wanted to portray, that even love, romantic love, can't break the bonds of good women who are good friends.
Yep.
I like that. And I also like that the women weren't judging each other. Pearl did not fit the normal definition of motherhood at that time. And even though Vera wondered about that, it didn't quite make sense to her. She didn't judge her for it.
No.
No, she understood that Pearl really lived for the cause more than she lived for any individual human being, including her son. And that is the nature of some people. And you have to say, okay, that's their gift. And then other people will come around and help pick up those pieces. And you know, it takes a village phrase kind of as part of that story.
Right.
But Pearl made sure that William was well taken care of by Vera. I mean, you know, she could have, I suppose, left her at her grandmother's, but that she knew that was not good. That he needed the warmth and love of Vera. So, yeah.
Yes, and Pearl is pure enough, I think, to not be jealous of Vera taking that role of kind of surrogate mother in there too. So these are women who are very, I think, comfortable in their own skin, and they're in very, very different ways. And, you know, not every relationship that has strains on it needs to be catty. And I wanted to take a different turn and celebrate the strength of those friendships.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So Camille, how long did you spend on this book?
I wrote it over the course of about a year, but most of my books kind of percolate for about 2 years before I put anything on paper, because usually there's a lot of ideas going on and you want to think about it and do initial research and kind of see which idea screams louder than the other one. So this one was in my head for a good solid 2 years and then a year to actually write it and edit it.
Wow. Well, let's go back to as you were, you know, your first book came out in 2016, but when did you start writing novels seriously?
The Memory of Us was my first novel, and sometimes we have novels in a drawer that we go back to. I did a lot of blog posts. I just didn't think I had a full novel in me, even though I really wanted to write a novel. So I got a lot of support from my husband, who believed I could do it before I did. And then I finally had the idea for what I wanted to do, and I sketched out my little skeleton of a plot. And with no education or guidance whatever, I just wrote this thing. And that took me very little time. I actually wrote The Memory of Us originally in 6 weeks, which was very fast. I drank a lot of Jack Daniel's pepper like a good Texas girl and stayed up late. But what I quickly learned in querying and sending it to agents is it was just not ready to go. I just felt like, oh, I got to the end. Let me send it to people and they will be so excited to give me a contract. And that's not how it works. So I spent probably 4 years, which was also, we were building a real estate business at the time and the kids were younger. So there was a lot going on, but I spent about 4 years, editing it, going to writers' conference, really learning craft better than I knew it. I had fundamental good writing skills, but it needed a lot of work. And so it took about 4 years from start to finish before I seriously queried agents knowing that it was ready to go.
Well, you know, I'm glad that you said that, because sometimes people do get the idea that that anybody can be a writer and that you don't actually have to get any education or learn how to write, that we all know how to write. And it's true that we do, but there's more to it than that.
It is. And you have to be really honest with yourself in the writing. And that's part of what I learned. There's a lot of people who, I knew I wanted to be traditionally published. That was my goal. And there's a lot of people who choose self-publishing for some very legitimate and wonderful reasons. But there's some people I've noticed who choose that because they don't want to go through the paces. You know, they get to the end and they're very excited they've got to the end and they're ready to share it with the world. And it's just not ready. They're amazing writers, but the book's just not ready. And so there's a segment of that that's in there. And if I had published, like, I don't want anybody to see what that first draft was anymore, because I look back at it now and I go, oh my gosh, it was not ready. I had to go through the paces of taking some, joining a writer's group, getting critiques, hearing the hard stuff, getting the rejection, rewriting and rewriting. And that to me makes you a writer, when you're willing to put yourself through the paces to have a goal happen.
Right. And having, you know, you have to be willing to let an editor work with you.
Absolutely. Definitely. My editor, who's edited my last three books, I had a different one for The Memory of Us, and he was amazing. But I have had the same editor for Before the Rain Falls, The Way of Beauty, and now the fourth one I'm finishing, the Beautiful Strangers. And it is a partnership. I mean, the role as an editor is so crucial that I feel like their name should be on the cover as well. And they don't rewrite anything, but they just point out where you can go deeper, where you maybe have too many coincidences, where you're not feeling enough. And I don't think most writers, including myself, are gifted enough to take that hardcore logical look at it. You've got to get other eyes on it, whether it's friends, you know, good writer friends reading it or something. You need to get the opinions and hear the hard stuff.
Right. You may be a fantastic editor on somebody else's project, but it's very hard to do it on your own.
Absolutely. I was just on the phone last night with my editor for something that she'd written in the notes of The Beautiful Strangers, the one that we're finishing now. And I asked her why she wrote this specific thing. And she pointed out how it completely contradicted something else I'd said. And when she said it, I went, oh my gosh, it's sitting right there. I just didn't see it. And she kind of laughed because it was actually so obvious. Once she pointed it out, and I just went, oh my gosh, you know, so you have a fantastic relationship with them, but you're too close to your work to pull out and see the big picture.
Right. Right. So how did you find an agent?
Knowing nothing about it, I just went online. How do you get an agent? And, the agents want what's called query letters for the most part, which is a one-page letter introducing yourself, introducing your book, talking about comparable books to it. It's quite a process. And I didn't do it very well in the beginning. My query letters were not good. They weren't super targeted to the right agents, and the book wasn't ready. But as each rejection came in, I really learned something from it. And by the time I got the agent that I did, in fact, I had two agents who ended up wanting to sign with me, I'd gotten much better about that process. And one thing I learned that I would pass to other writers is be very specific about why you're writing that agent, and read up on them, read other books that they have represented, read their biographies, and mention something in your query letter about, here's why you are being sent this, because you are the right agent for me. And when you're really specific about that, they're going to notice that more than the sort of, here's the generic one of 20 letters I'm sending off today. So it's a full-time job just to find an agent, but being really specific and careful about your letters is going to greatly increase your chances of getting attention.
How do you, I guess one way to do that is to look at books that are, that you love or that are similar in genre or in scope in some way to the book that you're pitching, and find out who the agent is. Now, a lot of authors do thank their agent in the acknowledgments, but if they don't, how is there another way to find out who the agent for the book was?
Gosh, almost every book I ever read thanks the agent in there. So I mean, my own experience is that I sat in Barnes & Noble and I just looked through the historical fiction section of books that I thought would be remotely similar to mine. And I looked up all the acknowledgments. I don't think there's one book I found where they didn't thank the agent. So that hasn't been my experience. I know that there's sites probably like on Publishers Weekly. There are some sites that you can pay a small fee to get into that have some pretty extensive information about agents. And you also can just Google, you know, literary agents, historical fiction, and you'll find a lot come up. But I literally sat in Barnes & Noble and looked through a lot of books.
I think that's a very effective way to do it, because then you really can target your queries to people who like the kind of book that you wrote.
Right. And the reason I wrapped up a good number of queries in the beginning is I just sent pretty generic letters out and sort of blanketed a lot of agents. And that's not the way to do it. This is something where it needs to be super targeted. And when I started doing that, I came up with this silly number. I just said, I'm going to query six agents at a time, but they're going to be really well-researched agents. The first time I defined those parameters for myself, two of the six wanted to sign, which was a great ratio.
Wow.
I wish I'd done that earlier.
That is great. That is great. Now, how did you decide which one to go with?
You know, I'm really a prayerful person, and I just often have gut instincts about things, and it literally came down to gut instinct more than anything. What I didn't know at the time is that my agent's actually a really big agent. I don't think I realized that about her. I just had a great rapport with her and just had this gut feeling that she's the right person. I prayed about the decision. And one thing I really liked about her is she was a Harvard-trained attorney originally. And because my book at the time had, it was about Eleanor Rigby, I didn't know if I'd run into legal challenges with that. So I really liked the idea of having an agent who had a legal background and could advise well on that. So a lot went into saying she's the one, and I'm still with her, and she's a wonderful champion for me, and I'm very grateful. Because now when people say, who's your agent, and I say Jill Marshall, they go, oh, she's great. The things you learn along the way.
Then once you assigned the agent, how long did it take to find the publisher?
It was a few months. She gave me some initial edits. I made some of those edits. She sent it out. We had a few rejections, and oddly, the majority of our rejections came from the fact that it was set in World War II. And we had some companies who said, we love the book, but we are saturated with World War II right now, and we just can't take any more on. So they actually really liked the book. We had an almost offer from one of the big five ones who just wanted me to change one element of the book, which I think they were completely right about, and I made that change. But while we were waiting to hear back from them, we got this offer from Lake Union. And Lake Union is where my agent really wanted me in the first place. And so it kind of became no question, this is the one we should take. And I just trusted her judgment, and it's been a fantastic match.
So tell us a little bit about Lake Union. I'm not familiar with that publishing company.
Lake Union is one of the imprints of Amazon. So Amazon is really my publisher. A lot of people, I didn't know this either, but a lot of people don't realize that Amazon is a traditional publishing house, just like Random House or St. Martin's Press or anything else. There's Amazon. And then they have these sub-imprints, as most houses do, which kind of focus on a certain genre. So Lake Union focuses on women's fiction, historical fiction, book club fiction. So I fell best into their category. And they're absolutely phenomenal because Amazon sells books better than anybody else. And so when they are not only your publisher, but your marketing wing, it's amazing. And their philosophy is we want writers writing, not spending all their time marketing. And it's a really different philosophy. So a lot of the big five will push a book really hard for the 2 weeks that it's out, and then they're on to a new cycle of new books. Amazon is continually doing promotions. I'm still getting promotions for The Memory of Us from 2 years ago, and still getting sales and still getting foreign deals. They're just still working even that first book. So they're fantastic, and my agent had the foresight to see that this is where authors are going to want to go, and she got me in there early.
Wow. Now, did you get a multi-book contract?
Not with The Memory of Us. So I sold that as a single title. I sold Before the Rain Falls as a single title. And then my agent said, let's pitch two books and try to get a two-book deal. And so that's what we did. I got the deal for The Way of Beauty and then the book that has become The Beautiful Strangers. So now I'm back to, we'll be pitching again in the summer. And there's no guarantees ever. So I don't take it for granted. And I'm going to work really hard on coming up with good pitches.
Do you have some ideas already?
I do. My first pitch is pretty well developed, and I'm very excited about that. It would take place in the 40s and the 60s. And then my other idea, it's just starting to percolate. It's kind of been sitting there for a while, but I have to plug characters into it and make sure I can make it work. So we're kind of looking at June or July to pitch these ideas, so that definitely gives me time to make my idea solid.
So obviously your first book was completely written before it was sold.
Yes.
Was the second one sold on a concept, or did you write it before you sold it as well?
The second and third were sold based on a synopsis of about, I think, two or three single-spaced pages and about five chapters. So that way they wanted to really know where you're going with the story and how does the story sound. But now they know I can finish a book. They trust me more. So the fourth one got sold on literally two paragraphs of an idea. And my agent is telling me for the fifth and sixth pitches, we can really just do something that's blurb length, something pretty short. They already know how I write. So they just want to see that my idea is sellable.
You seem to be able to write a book in less than a year. For the most part, if
apparently that's how it's working out. Yeah.
So
that's amazing.
What's your writing schedule like?
Well, ever since I quit my real estate career, I have a lot more time on my hands, which was designed that way. So we made a big step backwards financially to let me start this over. Moved into a smaller house and everything. We're really committed to doing this. So now I have a lot of free time that I didn't have. And my kids are all a little bit older. The first is even off to college. So I kind of write in spurts. When I get inspired, I might spend days just pushing through it, and then I might go 2 months and not write anything. And that's really not the most disciplined way to go about it, but I'm great at meeting deadlines, and I do meet my deadlines. But my goal is I'd like to have a goal of like 1,000 words a day. I'd like to get a lot more systematized, but I tend to write in spurts right now. I think that's just who I am.
Well, it certainly has paid off for you. I mean, gosh, a book a year, that's amazing.
When you're writing in bursts, then are you writing more than 1,000 words a day?
Yes. I wrote the end of my current fourth book. I wrote 12,000 words over 2 days.
Oh, my goodness.
So, I get super. My husband doesn't even like being around me. He said, just go to a coffee shop, go to the library, get out of the house, because nobody can talk to you when you're in that zone. And he's right, because when it just hits, I've just got to run with it. Because life and having kids, there's so many distractions that, when I finally have that spark, I've just got to go somewhere where there's no distractions and get it done. But I use that time really efficiently, and I get a lot done during that time.
Okay.
And then literally I may go 2 months and not do anything.
Is a coffee shop a place for you that does not have distractions?
Yes, because nobody's saying mom, mom, mom. Noise does not bother me. Mom, mom, mom. Well, not that mom bothers me, but it's pulling my, somebody needing me for something. And
yeah,
I want to
right.
be there. I want to say yes. In a coffee right. shop, nobody needs me for anything. But I actually really like the buzz. If it's quiet, my thoughts can actually go you know, just go all over the place. So I sort of like the background buzz. It's like, you know, a vacuum cleaner in the background for babies who like to sleep with noise. But it doesn't distract me.
Do you write on computer or by hand?
I write on a computer. I love handwriting. I write at least a letter a day. I love writing letters and snail mail, but I could not possibly edit well if I have handwritten books. So for me, it's all on the computer. Just Word, though. I'm really simple. A lot of people have some really super awesome, sophisticated programs like Scrivener, but I'm just, you know, Word and my laptop, and I'm good to go.
How about the planning? Go ahead, Mom.
I was wondering about the cover. How did they decide on the cover? Because it was very attractive, I thought.
He did a great job. Lake Union is so great with covers, and they have outside artists that they contract with. I think this particular one was out of Mexico for this one. And so they send me some initial concepts. Ultimately, it's their decision, but they do let me have some input. And so I saw all the various ideas for it. But the girl on the cover was always in the original idea, as was the background. The colors of everything changed pretty drastically over the course of things. But that girl was chosen from an old vintage photo. It was actually three girls walking together out of the building, and they were able to just extract this one image of one girl and put it on the cover and change the coloring from this old black and white photo. It was really fascinating to watch the process.
I'll bet. Yeah, well, it turned out really, really nice, I think.
Thank you. I love what they did.
When you're writing, like the planning process, the you say you have to write on computer because you need to edit, but how about, like, do you ever do like little character sketches or notes to yourself? Is that part of your writing process also?
Almost everything about a particular book goes right in there on Word. Sometimes if there's something I know I want to add later, not forget it, I'll just go to the end of the document and I have this little list of things that I, you know, make sure you include this somewhere in there. But just living life, I'm always making observations and I'm always finding things that would be great to put in books, little details about something, but it might not be right for the current book. So I do have, just in the section on my phone of notes, I have a section that's writing notes. And I just write down random observations. And then as I'm writing another book, I'll kind of go back to those and see if any of those still strike me in the same way and if they seem appropriate for that book. But the current book I'd be working on, everything stays in the same document.
What do your kids think of your books? Do they read them?
My oldest is a voracious reader like myself, so she's read all of them. My second daughter doesn't read quite as much. She's read the first one, and my younger two are just a little too young for it. But my oldest is off in college, and she loves to read, so she's read all of them.
Does she give you suggestions?
By the time she's reading them, they're pretty much done. She reads them at the stage where they've even been pretty well edited. So she doesn't add too much as far as suggestions go. She does give me good suggestions for just reading, which is great. But my books are very clean, so I would have no problem with any of my kids reading my books. There's nothing in there I wouldn't want them to see. They're just it's just a little bit over the heads of some of the younger ones.
Well, in your acknowledgments for The Way of Beauty, you talk about how this book came to be, that you were brainstorming with your daughter about what to write next. And so I'm
That was with my second daughter. Yeah, she's the one who's not so much of a reader, but she's a very creative person. And I was kind of just stuck. I knew I wanted to write again. I knew I wanted to write about New York, but just one day we sat on my bed together, just because she's a creative sort, and we just talked through ideas, and actually pretty much none of the ideas we came up with are what became this book, but just that process of being creative together ended up sparking, you know, the things that I wanted to do with it. But we had all sorts of things going on. There was going to be a father and daughter and a mystery box and a journal and all sorts of things that didn't make it into the book at all, but the process was good, and I would absolutely call her into the room again and brainstorm with her again.
And the image that you kind of settled on, which isn't exactly what was in the book either, was the idea of soldiers kissing their girlfriends goodbye in a train station. And although that does happen, it's not maybe the central part of the book, but the train station itself becomes a very important part of the book.
It does, and that's just how the evolution of it happens to me. A lot of what I do starts with location, and so I just had this image in mind of the sun streaming through the windows of this train station and all the little dust particles that look like diamonds, and the soldier kisses his girlfriend goodbye. And it was in wanting to flesh out that image, I started looking up images of train stations so that I could get the right image in my head. And that's where I discovered Penn Station. And it was learning the story of Penn Station, like I mentioned earlier, where I said, oh my gosh, here's my book. But it, I do have a very, very brief moment in the second part of the book where I do have soldiers kissing their girlfriends goodbye, but it did not become the meat of the story the way that the history of the train station itself did.
Wow. So one thing kind of leads to the next, doesn't it?
It does. And that's why I try to keep the plot really loose and open so that I can put that meat on there as it comes.
Well, do you ever get like 2/3 of the way in and have no idea how it's going to end?
I usually have a vague idea, but I'm willing to be flexible. So I'm not usually absolutely married to the idea of how it has to go. I absolutely sit down to the computer some days, though, and I'll say, okay, chapter 16. And my fingers sit there and I go, I have no idea what's going to happen in chapter 16. And I just start writing, and I surprise myself sometimes. Like on this fourth book, when I was in the middle of writing it, I ended up with this line at the end of a chapter that said, come in, Kate, I have somebody I want you to meet. And it's almost like that sentence wrote itself, because I sat there at the beginning of the next chapter and I said, well, who the heck is Kate supposed to meet? I have no idea. I really don't. It's just that's the line I finished up with. So.
Well, if you start out with one idea of where you're going and then you end up someplace else, do you then have to sometimes go back and change things earlier on because they don't make sense anymore based on where the story ended up going?
I do that in fairly small ways because obviously I want it to flow and have consistency. But I've never had something be so radically different that it needed to change in the beginning. My most radical edit was in Before the Rain Falls. And that was literally once the book was done and it was in the editor's hand. And that one was difficult because it took place in two different time periods, but with three different characters I was telling three different stories in two different time periods. And she loved the story, but didn't care for the timeline of it and how, in what order different events were happening. And so for that book, I kind of likened editing that book like if I crocheted a blanket for you that was striped and you thought it was beautiful, you loved all the colors, but you said, I want the blue stripe at the top and the white stripe in the middle and the yellow stripe at the bottom, you would have to redo the entire thing. And that's what happened with Before the Rain Falls I shuffled it into a completely different order, which worked way better. So to the big credit of my editor, she just saw a way better way to do it than how I had written it. So at the editing stage, that needed tremendous structural revision.
Wow.
And it just about killed me.
I bet. Camille, we're out of time. And I want to thank you so much for being with us today on Writer's Voices.
Having me. That was great to talk with you both.
Yeah. And the book again is The Way of Beauty. It's obviously available on Amazon, and probably you can get it wherever else books are sold.
Mm-hmm.
And Mom, do
I
you
love
have
supporting the independent bookstores too?
And independent bookstores, we love to, yeah, it's always good. Go in there. You can, if they don't have it, they'll order it for you.
Right. I love to send them money.
Yeah. Mom, do you have some final words for us today?
Yeah, you know, there are many stories and paths in every life. And for anyone else to ever read your writings, just for yourself or for your memories, write them down.
Thank you so much, and see you next week on Writer's Voices.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.